Chapter 19. Thomas Dwyer was a name that sounded serious and stayed. Even Dwyer's title, Scientist of Theoretical Physics, made one imagine a pipe-smoking academic, an egghead, or a man who lived a carefully controlled existence. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Dwyer was the captain of his darts team at the neighborhood pub, raced rally cars on the weekends and chased single women with a purpose his 40 years of age had not diminished. Dwyer bore a passing resemblance to the actor Jeff Goldblum, dressed more like a movie producer than a scientist, and read nearly 20 newspapers and magazines a day. He was smart, imaginative, and bold, and was as up-to-date on current events and trends as a fashion maven. His job title, however, could bring back the notion of a more serious side. His business cards read Central Intelligence Agency, Thomas W. Dwyer, TD, Senior Scientist Theoretical Applications. Dwyer was a spook scientist. At the moment, Dwyer was hanging upside down in a pair of gravity inversion boots that were attached to a bar that was secured to the door jamb leading into his inner office. He was stretching his back and thinking.
"Mr. Dwyer?" a junior scientist said meekly.
Dwyer glanced toward the voice. He could see a pair of scuffed brown leather shoes over white athletic socks leading to a pair of pants with the hem a touch too high. Arching his back, Dwyer raised his head enough to see who was speaking.
"Yes, Tim."
"I was assigned something I think is above my level," the scientist said quietly.
Dwyer reached up with his arms and grabbed the bar across the door, then he twisted himself around like a gymnast, removed the ankle boots from the bar, and dropped to the floor in one smooth motion.
"Saw that move in the last Olympics," Dwyer said, smiling. "What do you think?"
"Great, sir," the younger man said softly.
Walking into his office, Dwyer sat down behind his desk, then bent over and started removing the boots from his ankles. The younger scientist followed meekly, holding in his hands a file stamped with the words Echelon A1. Dwyer finished removing the boots, tossed them in a corner of his office, and reached out so Tim could hand him the file. He removed a sticker from the front, initialed it quickly, and handed it back to the junior scientist.
"It's my problem now," he said, smiling. "I'll analyze it and write the report."
"Thanks, Mr. Dwyer," Tim said.
"Call me T.D.," Dwyer said. "Everyone else does."
Thomas T.D. Dwyer was sitting in his office with his feet up on the desk. In his hand was a thesis on the natural formation of Buckminster fullerenes, more commonly called buckyballs, on meteorites. The spherical orbs, named for famed American architect R. Buckminster Fuller, who was most noted for designing the geodesic dome, are the roundest and most symmetrical large molecules known to man. Discovered in 1985 during a space experiment with carbon molecules, buckyballs have continued to astound scientists. When the hollow area inside the sphere is filled with cesium, it produces the finest organic semiconductor that has ever been tested. Experiments with pure carbon buckyballs have created a lubricant with almost no drag. Possible applications included the development of non-polluting engines, the timed introduction of medicines, and more advanced nanotechnology devices. The field of development was wide open and growing. Though the future uses were interesting, Dwyer was not concerned with that. He was more concerned with the present. Naturally occurring buckyballs had been found in the location of meteorite craters. When these samples had been examined, both argon and helium gases had been found in the hollow area of the spheres. Dwyer pondered this for a moment. First, he imagined two geodesic domes placed together to form an orb the size of a kickball or about the same size as the meteorite in the photograph. Then he imagined the void inside filled with gases. Next, he imagined piercing the orb with a skewer or lopping off the top with a sword. Whatever gas inside would leak out. Then what? Helium and argon were harmless and existed in abundance in nature, but what if these gases contained something else, something not of this world?
Opening the telephone directory inside his computer, he located a number and entered the command for the computer to dial. Once the computer signaled the line was ringing, Dwyer reached over and picked up his phone. Across the country, three time zones distant, a man walked toward his ringing phone.
"Nasuki,"
a voice answered.
"Mike, you old hack, this is T.D.
"T.D., you Mensa reject you. How's the spy game?"
Nasuki asked.
"I'd tell you, but it's so secret I'd have to kill myself."
"That's secret,"
Nasuki agreed.
"I have a favor to ask," Dwyer said.
Miko, Mike Nasuki, was an astronomer with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. NOAA is a division of the Commerce Department. The agency had a broad base to conduct scientific research, though they usually worked with hydrography.
"Is this a no-one-should-know-we-had-this-conversation favor?"
"That's right," Dwyer said. "All hypothetical and off the record."
"All right,"
Nasuki said.
"Let me have it."
"I'm looking into meteorites and particularly the formation of buckyballs."
"That's right up my alley,"
Nasuki said.
"Cutting-edge stuff."
"Have you ever heard of any theories about the makeup of the gases inside the spheres themselves?"
Dwyer said carefully.
"Perhaps why helium and argon are prevalent?"
"Mainly, those are the most common gases that would occur on another planet."
"So," Dwyer noted, "the potential is there for the inside of the balls to be filled with other substances, things not normally found on Earth."
Nasuki thought for a moment.
"Sure, T.D. I attended a symposium a few months ago where someone presented a paper that made the argument that the dinosaurs had been wiped out from a virus from space."
"Brought in by a meteorite?" Dwyer asked.
"Exactly,"
Nasuki said.
"There is one problem, however."
"What's that?"
"A meteorite 65 million years old has yet to be discovered."
"Do you remember any details about the theory?"
Nasuki searched his memory.
"The gist was that extraterrestrial microbes inside the helium were released on impact, and those that didn't burn up poisoned the life that existed at that time. There were two major points,"
Nasuki continued.
"The first was that the microbes were a fast-spreading virus, like a superflu, SARS or AIDS, that attacked the dinosaurs physically."
"What was the second?" Dwyer asked.
"That whatever was trapped inside the helium actually changed the atmosphere itself,"
Nasuki said.
"Perhaps altered the molecular structure of the air itself."
"Like what?" Dwyer asked.
"Depleted all the oxygen, that sort of thing."
"So the dinosaurs actually choked to death?" Dwyer asked incredulously.
Nasuki gave a low chuckle.
"T.D.,"
he said,
"it's just a theory."
"What if a meteorite formed primarily of iridium existed in a complete form?" Dwyer asked. "Not shattered by impact."
"Iridium, as you know, is both extremely hard and relatively radioactive,"
Nasuki said.
"It would make an almost perfect delivery system for a gas-borne pathogen. The radiation might even mutate the virus and change it, make it stronger, different, whatever."
"So," Dwyer said, "it's possible a mutant virus from millions of years and a billion miles away could be contained inside the molecules?"
"Abso-freaking-lutely,"
Nasuki said.
"I've got to go," Dwyer said quickly.
"Somehow,"
Nasuki said,
"I knew you were going to say that."